Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on War is a Racket, right after this. You know, 3,000 years ago, before the science of meteorology was even thought of, old King Solomon wrote in Ecclesiastes 1 verse 7 that all of the rivers run into the sea, and yet the sea is not full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. Well, every year the continents and islands of this earth pour down into the oceans a stupendous volume of water, about 286,000 cubic miles of it. For century after century, millennium after millennium, this has been going on, and the sea has not increased its level by so much as an inch. Now, how is all of this possible? We call it the circle, or cycle, of evaporation and precipitation. And the writer of Ecclesiastes said that the ocean maintains its level in spite of this gigantic annual influx, because the rivers go back to the place from whence they came, and indeed they do. Every drop of rain that falls climbs back upon the Creator's elevator of evaporation to form themselves into clouds, and then ride back to the head of their toboggan slide to begin their journey all over again. In the modern science of meteorology, all of this is understood and its laws are comprehended. Modern science has now learned what the writer of Ecclesiastes knew 3,000 years ago. And that's just one more of the many examples of science in the Bible. And it's one more of the many lessons in my Mosaic Law School that I conduct here twice a year at the law school in Isabella, Missouri. For more information, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package first. It's a place to start. It's the place to start. It's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free. You can call right now to order yours. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. All right, we're talking about a fellow by the name of Smedley. We know a guy with the name of Smedley. Sounds like something that came out of a Walt Disney movie, doesn't it? Smedley Butler was a 3-star Marine Corps general for 32 years. Well, he wasn't a general the whole 32 years, but he ended up as a general. That's what counted. And during the 1930s, he wrote some treatises, and he was active politically in the movement against World War II. There was this great dividing gulf in America, kind of split, you know, down the middle the way we are today over abortion. About half the people want it and about half the people don't. And about half the people want the war in Iraq and about half the people don't. You know, it's just, it's one of those kind of things that divides the nation. And so, at that time, during the 1930s, about half the people wanted to go to war against Hitler in Germany. About half the people didn't. America was officially neutral, and we were on the verge of going to war on the side of the Allies, France and Britain. And this fellow, Smedley Butler, the old-timey Marine general, he came out on the side of neutrality. Now, he had fought in the big war, you know, the big one, WW1. And it formed some opinions, and he came to a conclusion, and he said, you know, I don't think this is the smartest thing we ever got involved in. He wrote a book here called War is a Racket. War is a Racket. And I showed you from Chapter 1 and Chapter 2, he identified it as a racket, and then he said, these are the people that profit from it. And the people that profit from it have a lot of money. So when they go to Washington with their lobbyists, when the Boeing company goes to Washington with their lobbyists and the Lockheed Martin Convair Company and all these military operations, you know, the Halliburtons and Bechtels and all these guys. And then they walk in there to the halls of Congress. They're beating the war tom-toms. They want war. And after all, they've got a right to their opinion. Okay, they know everybody's got a right to his opinion. You know, if you're in favor of the war in Iraq, you know, that's your opinion. You certainly have a right to it. But there's another side to the story, and I kind of like this guy Butler's side to the story, because, you know, I wasn't even born when he wrote. I was born in 39, right at the end of the Great Depression. And I remember living through World War II, the rationing that went on and the fear of the bombing, you know, from the Japanese and one thing and another. And so I was pretty familiar with World War II and raised, you know, after the war was over with the belief that, hey, we got this communist menace and America needs to be defended and we need to be the defenders of democracy around the world, one thing and another. I'm just as much a victim of the propaganda machine as anybody else. But it was before my time and I didn't have an opportunity to listen to the other side. And the other side had a pretty valid argument. And after I have now seen that argument, I think that they were right and that the war side was wrong and that we should have stayed out of World War II, should have stayed out of World War I, and then there wouldn't have been a World War II. Because the Germans would have won the war, and World War I, that would have settled the issue. And then there wouldn't have needed to be a World War II, and communism never would have been a problem because the Germans wouldn't have allowed it. Not to say that the Germans might not have become a problem for us at some later date, but certainly no bigger problem than the Russians and the Chinese have posed since the German defeat in 1945. Now, it could well be, you know, that Mr. Butler over here was dead wrong. And after all, the events of war and the events of history have shown that he was on the losing side. So, from the perspective of the Southern states in the Civil War, we say, well, the Southern states were wrong because they lost the war. I don't think that they were wrong philosophically or politically. I think they were correct. It is true they lost the war, and they've been vilified ever since. But then that's because the winners write the history of the war. The Germans did not write the history of World War I or World War II. History, worldwide, boys and girls, is written by the Americans, the British, the French, and the Russians. We wrote World War II's history. We have controlled what you believe and what I believe. Somebody else told us this is the answer. But during this period of time, there were writers, just like there were writers during and after the Civil War. And they said, well, here's our aims and ambitions, and here's what we're fighting for. They don't get the popular press, and they don't get played up, and they don't get read in the public schools. But the literature is there. The information is available. So this guy, Smedley Butler, comes up with some pretty wild ideas concerning how to abolish war. And if you'll remember in the last program, he said the way to abolish war is to allow a plebiscite, and all the people that are going to fight in the war are the people that vote for or against it. You know, we're not going to allow that. The people that are going to decide whether we go to war in Iran are not the people that you've elected to office, not the people that are going to that are going to be responsible to you. It's the Committee of 300, the people that control the politicians, and the politicians are going to vote for or against war depending upon how they're told to vote. And their votes are for sale, and they're going to do what they're told, and they're going to vote the way they're bought. But Smedley comes up with a new concept. He said, what if we had a plebiscite and the soldiers who were going to be drafted into the war? What if we tried that today? Think about it. We're going to decide whether or not to cut and run from Iraq or to stay the course. Why don't you go to the guys that are over there fighting it? And that would be the young people about 18 to 26 years old that are going into the military or that are in the military today. And we have this plebiscite and everybody votes, say, well, shall we go to war or not? And then he had another neat idea. If you'll remember, he said, you know, when we go to war, we should pay everybody on this side of the Atlantic the same wages that we're paying the soldiers that are fighting over there. So in Iraq, you know, those guys are getting about $500 a month. And so all of a sudden, the chairman of the board at Boeing Aircraft, he gets reduced from whatever his salary is, $10 million a year, to $500 a month for the duration of the war. And he'd be on that restricted salary, you know, for the last 3 years. And so would all of the workers at Boeing and Lockheed Martin and all the manufacturers and Halliburton's and Bechtel's and so on. And everybody would be getting paid the same amount of money as the soldiers over there. And he said, you know how long this war would last? It wouldn't even get started. And if it got started, it wouldn't last 30 days. Now, boys and girls, there's a lot of money to be made in war, and that's why we have so much of it. And so our friend Smedley over here says, to hell with war. That was chapter 5. Remember that? To hell with war. And he says, I'm not such a fool as to believe that war is a thing of the past. I know the people don't want war, but there is no use in saying that we cannot be pushed into another one. Looking back, Woodrow Wilson was re-elected president in 1916 on a platform that he had kept us out of war, and on the implied promise that he would keep us out of war in the future. And yet 5 months after he was elected, he went to Congress and asked the Congress to declare war on Germany. In that 5 month interval, the people had not been asked whether they had changed their minds. The 4 million young men who put on uniforms and marched or sailed off to war were not asked whether they wanted to go forth to suffer and die. So what caused our government then to change its mind so suddenly? The answer was money. You see, there was an Allied commission, it may be recalled. They came over here to the United States shortly before the war declaration, and they called on President Wilson. And the president summoned a group of advisors. And the head of the commission spoke to this group of advisors. And when you take their statement, stripped of its diplomatic language, this is what he told the president of this group. He said, there is no use kidding ourselves any longer. The cause of the Allies is lost. We now owe you American bankers, American munitions makers, American manufacturers, and American speculators, and American exporters about $5 or $6 billion. If we lose this war, and without the help of the United States, we will certainly lose the war, we, England, France, and Italy, cannot pay back this money, and Germany won't pay it back. So. You see where we're at, boys and girls? Money. Had secrecy been outlawed as far as war negotiations were concerned, and had the press been invited to be present at that conference, or had the radio been available to broadcast these proceedings, America would never have entered World War I. But this conference, like all war discussions, was shrouded in the utmost secrecy, which all wars are, shrouded in secrecy. And then when our boys were sent off to war, they were told that it was a war to make the world safe for democracy and a war to end all wars. Now, 18 years after, the world has less of a democracy than it had then. And besides, what business is it of ours whether Russia or Germany or England or France or Italy or Austria live under democracies or monarchies? What business is it of ours whether they're fascists or communists? Our problem is to preserve our own government, our own republic. And very little, if anything, has been accomplished to assure us that the World War was really the war to end all wars. We are today on the brink of a new world war. And yes, we have had disarmament conferences and arms limitations talks and limitations of arms conferences, but they don't mean a damn thing. One has just been held, and it has just failed, and the results of another have been nullified. Now, we send our professional soldiers and our professional sailors and politicians and diplomats to these conferences. And what happens at these conferences? Well, the professional soldiers and the professional sailors do not want to disarm. No admiral wants to be without a ship, and no general wants to be without a command. And that's because both of these ends mean that these two men, the generals and the admirals, will be unemployed and without jobs. These admirals and generals are not for disarmament. And they cannot be for limitations of arms either. And at all of these conferences, lurking in the background, but all powerful, just as much as if they were taking part in the conference talks themselves. But in the background, just the same, are these sinister agents of those who profit by war, the munitions and the manufacturers. They see to it that these conferences do not disarm, and they see to it that they do not seriously limit any armaments. The chief aim of any power at any of these conferences has been not to achieve disarmament in order to prevent war, but rather to endeavor to get more armament for itself and less for any potential foe. And there's only one way to disarm with any semblance of practicability, and that is for all nations to get together and scrap every ship, every gun, every rifle, every tank, and every warplane. And even this, if it were at all possible, wouldn't be enough. The next war, according to experts, will be fought not with battleships and artillery, not with rifles and guns. It'll be fought with deadly chemicals and gases. Secretly, each nation is studying and perfecting newer and ghastlier means of annihilating its foes wholesale. But yes, you can bet that ships will continue to be built because the shipbuilders demand that they make their share of the profits. And guns will still be manufactured, and powder and rifles will be made, because the munitions makers must make their profits. And of course, the soldiers, of course, must wear uniforms, and those manufacturers of the uniforms must make their profits also. But victory or defeat will be determined by the skill and ingenuity of our scientists. In the final analysis, it'll be science. And if we put them to work making poison gas and more fiendish mechanical and explosive instruments of destruction, they will have no time for the constructive job of building a greater prosperity for all peoples and peace on earth. By putting them to this useful job, we can all make more money out of peace than we can make out of war. Even the munitions makers could make more out of peace than war if we put our minds to it. So I say, to hell with war. Now, that statement came from General Smedley Butler. Now, Butler had a couple of more neat ideas, I thought. He wrote a paragraph here or two on the common sense of neutrality. Now, there's a couple of countries in the world that have practiced this neutrality. Switzerland and Sweden. During World War I and World War II, those two countries opted out. They weren't siding with one side or the other. They minded their own business, and when they both came out of the war, they both did quite nicely. Now, other countries in the world didn't get involved. Brazil, Uruguay, Paraguay. The countries of South America, they were neutral. The countries of Africa, most of them were neutral. Now, it's certainly true that war came to the islands of the Pacific, and it's certainly true that war came to Australia and Great Britain, France and Europe, China. But the argument for the neutrality of the United States, I thought, was quite compelling. Quite compelling. You see, the war side said, we have to go to war, because if we don't fight them over there, we'll be fighting them over here. That's the argument that I hear President Bush making today. It's an argument that's been used, boys and girls, for thousands of years. If we don't fight the Arabs in Jerusalem, we'll be fighting the Arabs in London and Paris. That's what they were saying in the Crusades. So we went over to Jerusalem to fight them over there. Now, that's what President Bush is telling us, and a lot of the war people here in the United States are telling us. If we don't fight these terrorists in Iraq, we'll be fighting them in Los Angeles and Chicago. Excuse me. The people in Rio de Janeiro and Brasilia and Caracas, Venezuela aren't fighting any terrorists. They seem to be doing all right. We don't see any terrorist problems in Switzerland or Sweden, Norway, Iceland, do we? You know, there's something to be said about butting out and minding your own business. Now, we Americans haven't been butting out and we haven't been minding our own business, and we've been involved in a lot of wars in the last 50 or 75 years. And it's good for business. I don't deny that. Listen, it's good for the economy. I don't deny that. I'm not sitting here beating the tom-toms for peace. I can readily see the advantages of war. I can see the money to be made in war. Now, I watch the McNeil-Lehrer news report at night, and about every, you know, two or three times a week, they will have the pictures of the most recent dead soldiers, Marines, and sailors from Iraq. And they have a moment of silence, and for about 10 seconds, they will show a picture, and they will tell you that this is Joe Smedley from Moscow, Idaho, and he was a sergeant. And maybe a couple other items about his age or something like that, and what his job was in the military. And you look at that young face on there, and that man just died. He's dead. And that's why they're showing his face. And there'll be 10 or 12 of them. In the month of October, there was about 100. Now, when you stop and think about the death toll, it is really low. Boys and girls, for war, to be suffering this few casualties, 3,000 casualties, my God, on Normandy, you could take any battle of World War II. Take Iwo Jima. My God, those guys fought in there for 30 days and killed 6,000 or 8,000 people and wounded another 25,000. One battle, 30 days. I mean, we've been here in this, fighting this war in Iraq now for 3 years and don't have anywhere near the battle casualties that we had over in Iwo Jima, for crying out loud, in 30 days. So, you know, you can say what you want about Rumsfeld and Bush. Their prosecution of the war, tactically, militarily, isn't bad. But you can't get over the fact that each and every day that goes by, here's another two or three Americans that are killed. Another two or three Americans that are killed. See, if McNeil-Lehrer did that with automobiles, and every time, you know, every day, you know, here's how many people were killed in the United States today. It's about 45,000 a year. Divided by 365 would be 123 people a day die on America's highways. We're not showing pictures of Americans that die on the highways every day on McNeil-Lehrer now, are we? But we want to show these two or three that die over in Iraq. It's almost like a death wish. If you just keep doing that, you destroy the will of the people to resist, the will of the people to continue the war. The war isn't being won by the insurgents. The war is being lost by the press, by the media. That's where your real problem is. But Smedley came up with another idea. He said, why don't we just stay neutral in all of this? Why don't we just butt out and leave the Arabs to do whatever the Arabs are going to do? Why do we need to bring democracy to Iraq or Iran? Why do we believe that it's necessary for us Americans to interject ourselves on the Korean Peninsula and separate this North and South based upon their governmental aspirations? Why is it important to us to meddle in Darfur, in the Sudan, with the Arabs and the blacks? I know it's there. We've got this. We've got to do this. But I'm just asking you, what's the purpose behind it? The Swiss don't seem to be getting involved with the Darfur problem. The Swiss aren't involved in sending troops to the Korean Peninsula to promote democracy in the South or the dictatorship in the North. The Swedes aren't getting involved in Iraq. They're not butting their nose in over there. And conversely, you don't see the Arabs staging terrorist attacks in Stockholm or Zurich. Could it be that if we Americans butted out, minded our own business, that maybe 90% of the problem would just disappear. So he comes up with the thing here called common sense neutrality. And he said from the 1939 J.J. Little and Ives Company in New York book, compilation of non-interventionist essays and speeches by a number of people, including Eleanor Roosevelt and Dr. Harry Elmer Barnes and Colonel Charles A. Lindbergh. Here's the common sense neutrality published in that book. Butler says, let's look over this European brawl and see where we stand on it, or why we should stand anywhere on it for that matter. First of all, let's see if we have contributed one single thing to cause this problem in Europe, and also let's see if even a part of the responsibility for it can be pinned on us. And then finally, let's see if we have anything at all to do with the problems that are going on in Europe today. Now remember, this is written in 1939. If we think it over calmly, we all know perfectly well that we Americans did not have one solitary blessed thing to do with the making of the mess that's going over in Europe today. And that there is no possible sane and logical reason why we should feel any impulse to take a hand in it. Did we have anything to do with the promises that Great Britain and France have made to Poland? The answer is no, we didn't. Did we have anything to do with Hitler's land grabbing? The answer is no, we didn't. Did we have anything to do with Britain and France declaring war on Germany? The answer is no, we did not. We certainly did not, and we were not even consulted, much less asked. Now, these are some very smelly things that are going on in this armpit of European back alley politics into which we will most assuredly be sucked in if we don't watch our step. If we are fools enough to allow ourselves to get all excited about this brawl that's now going on over in Europe, as such brawls have since the dawn of history, before they started this row over land and natural resources, did any of these contending factions in Europe ask our advice or tell us of their plans? Did any of these warring sides ask for our good wishes or even for our opinion? The answer is no, they did not. None of them. And we neither advised nor encouraged them. So why should we get all stewed up about it and furnish the ammunition to keep it all going? Just because people on the other side of the world insist on continuing their own age-old practice of committing mass suicide, do we then as a nation have to follow their example and blow our brains out also? Are we to adopt a policy of sitting around this European cockpit and going to the rescue of our favorite cocks whenever they get themselves into a fight they might not be able to win without us? Are we to become so entangled in European high-pressure politics that the main issue at our elections will be whether or not to allow political changes abroad? If we're to make it our practice to take a part in these cockfights over there, we should certainly vote on it, have it in all of our national political platforms every time we have an election. 25 years ago, we sold them munitions and then had to go abroad and bail out France and Britain, helped drench the gore-sodden fields of Europe with the blood of 250,000 of our America's finest boys, the pride of our manhood, helped sow the seeds of the present orgy. We spent $50 billion or more on the venture. Are we going to keep on doing that? Are we to blame because Hitler built himself a great hair-trigger war machine that crushes everything in front of it? Are we responsible that England and France did not build a war machine to stop him? Are we culpable in any way because Hitler started before the other side was ready? Provided Britain and France really want to stop Hitler, are we to make up for their failure to prepare to do so by sticking our own necks out? Suppose you were walking down a strange street in a strange town in a strange country thousands of miles from your hometown. You come across a brawl. You don't have any real interest in this fight. But all of a sudden, you hear one of the brawlers cry out in your native English tongue as he swats his opponent. He says, "I believe in democracy." Now, you don't know in the least what the fight is about, but your sympathies are naturally at once with this fellow who speaks your own language and claims that he believes in the same political ideology that you believe in. The believer in democracy sees you hesitate and he shouts, "Come on and get in this fight. We believe in the same things. And also, don't forget, if this other fellow wins, you'll be next. You'd better come in now. You'd better fight him here or you'll be fighting him over there." So you reply, "Well, no, I don't think I want to do that. I'm a stranger and I don't want to get mixed up in this. I like you, but I don't like you enough to get into your fight. I just want to be neutral." "Well, all right," he says, "be neutral if you want. But you can gather up all the stones, clubs, and brick bats that you can lay hold on and sell them to me, and I'll use them on this other fellow." Now, that's a swell way to remain neutral, isn't it? You sell the weapons to one side, but not the other. Now, do you really think that if you start handing your Democratic friend ammunition, that you're not going to get sucked into this fight? You can't help it. If he's losing, or if he wins, he will only call you a scab. And if he wins, he will say he could have won by himself anyhow and declare that he owes you nothing. And if he loses, he'll always hate you because you made money out of his necessity. And in the end, both sides will hate you. On the other hand, if you stay out of the fight, with which you don't have anything to do with in the first place, the argument that if the other fellow wins, he'll give you a good beating too, won't apply. You will have gone on with your own business instead of butting into a fight where you didn't belong. And better still, the winner won't find you right there on hand and ready to be chewed up next. You'll be thousands of miles away and he'll have to come after you. Well, they say, "Well, if the French and the British don't lick Hitler, he'll come over here and jump on our necks. He'll be bombing our women and children, shelling our cities. Don't let anyone feed you that line of rot. It doesn't take military education to figure out what I'm going to tell you." So here's what Butler said about, "Well, if Hitler licks the British and the French, he'll be coming over to get us next." But before we get into Butler's response, let me give you a reminder. And that reminder is that you are listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. And if you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse and recommend are going to reciprocate. Most of these authors and publications that we use or cite here on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily wholly endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. But the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you do hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers, the sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Smedley Butler was a three-star Marine Corps general, wrote the book War is a Racket. We're citing and reviewing the book War is a Racket. You can get a copy from Barnes & Noble. I forgot the price now. It's just a little book. It's about 60 or 70 pages. Not very big. You can read it probably in an hour. Butler was vilified and hated by the FDR administration, the Roosevelt people, back during World War II, because he was a neutralist. He believed in neutrality. Says butt out. It's a wild new concept for Americans. We haven't done that for 100 years or more. Butt out, and mind your own business. So I mentioned the Swedes and the Swiss. They seem to have maintained their neutrality for quite a long time and butted out of other people's wars, and they've had more peace than most people in the world have had. Now, of course, somebody says, well, the bully has to beat up on somebody, so he's going to beat up on the Poles, or he's going to beat up on the Czechs, or the Austrians, or somebody else. You know, that could well be. Bullies beat up on people. And I suppose, from the American point of view, we need to go out here and protect all of the victims of bullies around the world. I'm not quite sure why we don't protect the people of Cuba from Castro, or the people of North Korea from Kim Il-jung, or whatever his name is, or the people from Darfur from the ruling elite in the Sudan. I mean, is there any place in the world that there isn't trouble that we couldn't get involved in if we put our minds to it? I mean, we've been in Somalia and Ethiopia and, you know, Eritrea and all over Europe. We have troops stationed in 126 countries around the world. And, of course, we have more wars and more problems than most people around the world. And, of course, we keep professing that we want peace. But, you know, we Americans spend $500 billion a year on war. We spend more money on war in the United States than everybody else in the world combined. Now, what's that tell you? Americans are peace-loving people, and hey, we're just looking out for the best interests of the underdog. Now, you need to remember that Saddam Hussein did not attack us. We might have gone to war believing that he did, or that he would, or that he was a bad guy, or that the people over there had weapons of mass destruction, or they needed regime change, and we went over there to save their bacon. But we're on the verge of losing that war. In the final analysis, we're going to lose. That's the bottom line. Just like Vietnam, we're going to lose. We're going to win every battle and lose the war. Is that the end you wanted? Because if it is, you've succeeded. Now, this fellow Butler, he had a little different take on that. His take on it was, you know, if you butt out, let Hitler defeat the British and the French and everybody else that he messes with, and let him do his thing in Europe, and we'll do our thing in America. If he comes over here, we'll take him on. And, of course, that was the argument that the war people used. You know, if we don't fight him over there, we're going to be fighting him over there. Well, Butler had an answer to that. Now, remember, this guy is a three-star general. So when I hear these people, you know, the people that tell us this story, you know, if we're not fighting these terrorists over there in Iraq, we'll be fighting them over here. The people that are telling us that, they're not military people. Not a one of them ever spent a day in the Army or in the military. Donald Rumsfeld, hell of a nice guy, never spent a day in the Army. George Bush, he can say that he spent a little time in the Air National Guard when he wasn't snorting coke, or he wasn't drunk driving, or when he wasn't going to a party. He's the only one that can say that, because all the rest of the people, including our vice president, most of the people in Congress, never spent a day in the Army. They don't know their hind ends from a hot rock. when it comes to war. This guy here, now, he's got some credentials. There's a fellow in Pennsylvania who's been opposed to this Iraq war right from the beginning. His name is Murtha. He's a Marine guy. You know, I don't know what his rank was. He was a major or a colonel or something like that. And, you know, he said, hey, listen, this strategy you guys are following over there isn't worth the sour owl doo-doo. And the people that engineered this war were these neocon thinkers over in the Pentagon. You know, a guy by the name of Wolfowitz and Pearl. You know, people that never spent a day in the military and are probably working for a foreign government to start with. And are lobbyists for war. Now, you know, there's got to be lobbyists, and we're not opposed to people exercising their right to free speech. And they did, and they sold their concept. They came along and said, we need war. And the American people said, well, we're listening to the people that are opposed, and we're listening to the people that are in favor, and we decide that we want to go to war. We did that in World War II. We had this neutrality faction, so let's butt out, and Butler was one of them. And then we had the war faction, of which Roosevelt and that gang said, hey, we need war, and the American people said, okay, we need war. I'm not opposed to you people making your choice. You made your choice, and you got to live with it. But I wanted to suggest to you that before you take on the North Koreans and the Iranians, that you listen to this guy's reason, logic, and common sense. Not that it's going to prevent you people from going to war against the Iranians and the North Koreans, but you're not going to make any money at it. There's no money in it for you. There's a lot of money in it for Boeing and Bechtel and Halliburton and thousands of other defense contractors. Don't get me wrong. There is tremendous profit, lots of money to be made in war. But the average Joe Sixpack down here on the bottom line is going to be paying for this for the rest of his life in a poorer living standard. And then remember this lady, Cindy Sheehan, who lost her boy over there, and she was really upset about it, and she went down and she lobbied, you know, and she picketed President Bush. I didn't see her lobbying and picketing in front of her boy telling him to stay the hell out of the army, but, you know, she was all in favor of the war. You know, when things are going good, everybody's in favor. This guy, Murtha, he wasn't in favor of it. In fact, he was opposed to it, and he said so. And this guy, Butler, he was opposed to it, and he said, here's why I'm opposed to it. Now, let's listen to his logic here. I think it makes a lot of sense. Butler goes on to say, it will not take less than 1 million soldiers to invade the United States with any hope of success. These 1 million men must come all at once. And they must bring with them not less than 7 tons of baggage per man. Now, 1 million soldiers, 7 million tons of food, ammunition, and whatnot. For instance, just one item. They must bring 400,000 vehicles alone. Tractors, 50 gallons of gasoline per day for each vehicle for 270 days. That's a 9-month supply. There are not enough ships in the whole world, including our own merchant marine and navy, if you added them all together. And I don't expect that we would lend them ours to bring their soldiers over here to attack us, to carry that kind of an expedition. And remember, these ships have to bring with them enough fuel to get over here and to get back home with, to make the round trips. And we certainly aren't going to give them the fuel, are we, over here to go home with. I think any dumb cluck can see that. But here's some more. We've got to have harbors to lie in, docks in which to unload their stores. You know, you can't stop 25 miles out in the ocean and drop off 50-ton armored tanks and tell it to swim ashore and meet you in Broadway someplace in New York City. You need to remember that with all of the harbors, docks, and ships of England and France at our disposal in World War I, it took us 19 months to get 1,900,000 men to France. And that, though this expedition was headed for a friendly country, and that all possible help on the other side was ours, it took nearly 2 years of preparation after the United States had actually declared war before it was safe to send our troops over there. Now, you know very well that we're not going to open our doors to them, prepare docks for them, and invite them in. New York is the only big port that we have on this coast, and to block New York Harbor, all you have to do is dump 2 days' garbage into the channel instead of hauling it out to sea. Now, can't you see it's all a question of supply? This invading business with men and munitions always runs out before the supply of men is exhausted. You don't have to go to West Point to figure this out. Just figure it out for yourselves. For every man at the front, you have to have 4 men or 5 men in the rear. You have to ship every day of the year from your Home Depot 1,000 pounds of supplies, food, ammunition, gasoline, clothing, medical supplies, engineering supplies, spare parts, to say nothing of replacements of the above. If you've got 200,000 men at the front, you'll have to have at least 800,000 men supplying them from the rear, and you'll have to send them 100,000 tons of supplies every day. Now remember also that for every 1,000 miles you go across the ocean on an invading expedition into hostile territory, you have to take with you 90 days' stores of all kinds. It's over 3,000 miles across the Atlantic. 3 times 90 is 270 days. That's 9 months. There is no supply of a European army in America that can be mounted from Europe by anybody, and in fact, couldn't be supplied by all of them combined against us. That is, an army big enough to land here. And there's another thing that you need to remember. No fleet can operate more than 1,500 miles from its base, and Germany proper would be the base of a Hitler invading fleet. Hitler could not get his fleet over here, or get it home again, and if he did. But they say he might build a base somewhere in South America. Well, listen, my friends, those who got up that little idea overlook the fact that it is further by a good deal from Berlin to South America than it is from Berlin to New York. Now, why in the world would Hitler invade America by way of South America? That makes less sense than in invading New York City. For when Hitler got to South America, he'd be further away from us than if he had come straight across from Berlin to start with. So don't let that frighten you either. It's all propaganda. It is a part of the insane to talk of Hitler invading us. And don't forget, too, that we have a navy of our own, don't we? And it's best, or the best, in the world, too. Now, what about an aerial invasion? Well, Colonel Lindbergh and Eddie Rickenbacker, the two foremost flyers that we have, already have told us it's ridiculous to talk about an invasion by air, or to talk or think about bombing New York from Berlin. But suppose they do invent a plane that might be able to do it. That airplane has got to make the round trip, too, and without landing, and with the fuel with which it started. And even if they build a plane that'll do that, we have enough brains in this country, I'm sure, to make some sort of a machine that will destroy it before it hurts our own women and children. And don't forget that we have an air force of our own, don't we? And a fine one, too. So let's take one thing at a time. Before we get stampeded into going to war over there, let's take it a step at a time right here. This war is going on in Europe. It isn't over here. And it's not going to come over here unless we invite it. And the best way to invite war over here is to raise this embargo and sell bombs and munitions to one side or the other. They'll have the stamp of American makers all over them, and they have the RSVP that will bring about that invitation. An invitation to go over there and join in the mess. And then there's that bogey. That bogey is to come, will come over here. Well, don't be alarmed by that either. No one in Europe can afford to leave home. Why, if Hitler were to leave Germany with 1 million men to go anywhere, if he ever got back, he'd find everybody speaking French or Russian. Those babies would move on him while he was gone. There isn't a single crazy war dog that can come over here. We can build a defense of our own country that not even a rat, much less a mad dog, could creep through. Now, remember, this is prior to World War II. Well, it's prior to us getting involved in World War II, probably just at the beginning, September, October, November, December, probably of 1939. It's got a 1939 date on it. Now, remember, two countries over in Europe stayed neutral, the Swiss and the Swedes. And this guy Butler is over here on this side of the Atlantic saying, you know, we Americans ought to butt out this time. And we made a mistake getting involved the last time. Why don't we butt out and let those guys fight their own battles? And no doubt the British and the French would have been defeated. The French were defeated. And the British probably would have been defeated. Does that mean that all of the British would have left England or all the French would have left France? I mean, you know, let's think about it in pragmatic terms. World War I was fought and lost by the Germans. They came back and fought again, and they lost again. Aren't the Germans still over there in Germany? Aren't the Russians still in Russia? The Poles are still in Poland. And for many years, the Poles had a communist government, and now they've got a communist government with another name. And the English have a communist government, and they call it parliamentary some procedure, I believe it is, parliamentary government. The French, they have a communist government. Hell, we Americans have a communist government. And this guy Smedley said, wouldn't it be a good idea for us not to adopt this communism? Why don't we opt out? Why don't we stay with our own form of government, butt out, and leave those people to theirs? Well, it was a wild concept at the time, and it was overruled, and the people of America decided, no, we're going to go to war. That's what we want to do. That's what we're going to do. And that's what you did. Well, are you any better off for it? I mean, after you spent all the money on World War II, and then you went to work defending against Russia, because now with Germany out of the game, the Russians were in it. My old granddad, you know, he came up with a marvelous idea. He was a neutral guy, too. He was on the neutral side with this guy Butler. He said, you know, I think what we ought to do is to watch which side is getting ahead of the other side and then supply them with munitions. And then when the balance turns, you change sides and you supply the Germans. And then you change sides and you supply the other sides. And let those guys fight and kill each other until they finally get tired of it. I don't know, just a kind of a wild idea from an old-timer, you know, from the olden days. You know, you supply one side and then you supply the other side, or you sell to one side or you sell to the other side. Butler came up with a little better idea, I think, than my granddad had. He said, why don't we just butt out all together and let those guys duke it out? One side will win, the other side will lose. And you know, that's ultimately the end of Iraq. You know that? In the final analysis, you got three competing factions, the Kurds, the Sunnis, and the Shiites. And when it's all said and done, one side, one group is going to dominate the other two. Or they're going to split the country up into three separate autonomous regions. Kind of like they just did in Yugoslavia. Now, we Americans, at least from our point of view, from our government's point of view, we wanted to go over there, take their oil, put up a puppet government, and operate that government from Washington, D.C. through the State Department. That was our goal. And then those Arabs over there, they said, no, we don't think that's a very good idea. We think we'll fight with that. Now, just take a look at what's going on over there. If 12,000 Arabs over there can take the world's number one military power and fight us to a standstill. Boys and girls, don't you think that the United States of America, doing the same thing here in the United States of America against a German invading army, could have done the same thing against the Germans or the Russians or anybody else? You ever think about that? Just thought I'd throw that out, because that was the conclusion that this three-star Marine general came to. He said, you know, just looking at the problem that the Germans, the Russians, or the English, or French, or the Japanese, or anybody else has in invading the United States. It is true, during World War II, the Japs fired a few shots from the deck gun of a submarine at Oregon. They set off, I think, a dozen or two dozen fire barrage balloons, and they attacked Pearl Harbor. I mean, that was about the extent of it. Now, there was a lot of hysteria. I can remember as a little kid, there was a tremendous amount of hysteria over this thing of the Japanese attacking us. And they, and oh my God, you know, we gotta go to war. The war hysteria won the day, no doubt about it. The war propaganda won the day, just like war propaganda won in Iraq. But this guy Smedley comes along, Smedley Butler, and he says, now wait a minute, boys and girls, before we get stampeded into a second round of world war here, let's think about this. And that's where I'm at today. I'm saying, now before we get stampeded into this next round of war with Iran or the next round of war with North Korea, why don't we think about this for a second? I know it's a wild new idea for Americans, but let's mull this over a minute. What vital interest do we have in North Korea? What vital interest do we have in the outcome of the beef that the South Koreans and the North Koreans have? Boys and girls, I can't think of any reason for us to get involved in their beef. And it may well be that the North Koreans will come down and beat up on the South Koreans, our allies, our friends in the South that we've been protecting for the last 50 years. And I'm sitting here saying, well, okay. Why is it our duty to protect the South Koreans from the North Koreans? Why is it our duty to protect the free Chinese on Formosa from the Chinese communists on the mainland? Now, we've made it our business. I don't deny that. We've gotten involved. But now you just had this election and you said, well, we're just really bummed out over this war in Iraq. Why in the hell should you be bummed out? It's the price of empire. You know, if you want to be the world's policeman, then you're going to get your nose bloodied every once in a while. And this guy Butler says, I don't think it's necessary for us to get our nose bloodied at all. Least of all, every once in a while. Why don't we butt out? There's more money to be made here in North America, minding our own business, than there is gallivanting around the world, making the world safe for Standard Oil, or Boeing Aircraft, or Lockheed Martin, or some other multinational corporation. Let those multinational corporations duke it out as best they can. Let's take United Fruit Company. Is it our duty to go down and intimidate the governments of Nicaragua and Costa Rica and others into selling bananas to us at some favorable price? You know, if you don't like the price of something, leave it alone. Why do we have to buy from the United Fruit Company? How come we can't buy bananas from the Costa Ricans or somebody else? I mean, if you can buy automobiles from Honda or Toyota, why can't we buy bananas from somebody other than the United Fruit Company? I know it's a wild new concept for most Americans, but that's the conclusion that Mr. Butler came up with. And I wanted to echo that because I think if he wrote this book last week, it would be just as applicable today in our beef with the Iranians and North Koreans and the Iraqis and Afghanis as it was in 1939 with our beef with Hitler and the Russians and the French and the British and the Japs and everybody else. And you always want to remember that the Swiss and the Swedes butted out, minded their own business, and they came out of the whole fray pretty well. And Butler thought that if we butted out, we'd probably come out of the fray just about as well as they did. And we would be doing business with Hitler and the Germans instead of with the British and the French. That's the only difference. Which we're doing business with all of them anyway today, and we would have been doing business with all of them anyway. So were the French. So are the British, so are the Swiss, so are the Swedes. I'm about out of time again. I'm going to have to give you a final reminder here, and we'll take it up next time, that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. And remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information about that, then go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. That website, by the way, is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives and can be accessed through the website. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Our time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody. And good night, friends.